Tuesday, March 26th. Welcome into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman. Aaron, busy show today,
yeah,
Cherry.
What's going on?
We know that a lot of your thoughts are with the folks down in Baltimore dealing with the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. It's a very fluid situation, but we did want to bring an expert on to talk more generally about the shipping industry, the supply chain industry, and how this could be affected, the ripple effects of this calamity down in Baltimore. So we're going to do that at the end of this segment. Middle segment today is an interview with Ralph Young, who is a historian at Temple and has written a couple of books about the history of dissent in America. And he argues basically that dissent is core to who we are and to our national story. So we're going to talk with him about that book, Cherry.
Yeah, First Amendment. First thing, protects freedom of religion, right to speech, press, petition the government, and to gather. So it's baked right on into America. I'm looking forward to that discussion.
I am as well. And then we're going to end the show today talking to New Jersey Attorney General Matt Platkin, specifically about his involvement in this major antitrust suit against Apple. And it all centers around that thing that might be in your pocket right now, your iPhone. So we'll ask him why he is involved in this case, why this case is taking place in New Jersey, and what he hopes the remedy might be.
Yeah, we both have iPhones. And
you
we
have
enjoy
two iPhones.
I do, and we get to enjoy the blue bubble. Some people don't, and we'll talk about that as well. But if you have any comments about our middle segment on dissent, have you been part of protests? What do you think about dissent in America? You can email us studio2@whyy.org, or you can call 888-477-9499. So we're going to start our news roundup. A story that caught my eye. Philadelphia Prisons Commissioner Blanche Carney is retiring, Avi. Her last day is April 5th. She tendered her retirement March 8th, but told her staffers on Monday. She started the position back in 2016, and the past few years have been extremely rough for Carney. She weathered the pandemic, staff vacancy rates hovering at 40%, disorder in the jails. There were people murdered inside of the jail. There was also violence within the jail. And you may remember, four people escaped from Philly prisons within 6 months. She's been taking it from all sides. The Philly jails have been sued by advocates saying, you know, the staffing shortages have caused constitutional rights to be violated of the inmates. Also, the union that represents correction officers, Avi, they did a vote of no confidence against Carney last year, had been calling, you know, what was happening in the jails chaos. So now, of course, Carney, she said she was proud that she held on steadfastly through very rough periods. The mayor accepted her resignation and now is casting a national search for her replacement.
Tough job.
Yeah. Yeah.
And definitely a tough job when there's a labor shortage. I think she kind of had a reputation as a reformer,
yes,
a reform-minded
person. She came
in,
when
she came in. So it'll be interesting to see who they replace her with and whether that person has a similar background.
Yeah,
or
and
not.
By the way, she was the first Black woman to fill this role, and she had been a social worker doing restorative justice programs. But 2016 was way different than once the pandemic hit, a lot of things changed.
Coming up, we've got a primary here in Pennsylvania, which means there are a lot of races for State House, but it seems every cycle we zero in on a couple of particular importance. And there are going to be a lot of eyes on Northeast Philadelphia, specifically State House District 172. That's sort of Fox Chase, Ron Hurst area. It's currently represented by Kevin Boyle, who's a Democrat, who, you know, I don't want to go through everything here, but has had, you know, a couple of public outbursts, has been in the media for not great reasons over the last couple of years. And he is being challenged in the primary by Sean Dougherty. Boyle and Dougherty are probably pretty familiar names if you follow Philadelphia politics. Brendan Boyle, Kevin's brother, is a U.S. rep. Sean Dougherty, it's not a coincidence here, is the son of Supreme Court Justice Kevin Dougherty and the nephew of former labor leader John Dougherty. So it's kind of like two, you know, mini Philadelphia political dynasties clashing in this one seat. It's also an important seat because it could kind of be a toss-up. There are a couple of Republicans running in that party's primary, And the Republicans do think they could possibly flip this district because it's not as blue-leaning as many Philadelphia House districts. So a lot of eyes on Northeast Philly, 172 coming up for the primary and then the general in November.
And it's a pretty big deal because we all know that the Pennsylvania House has it's very tight. The Democrats have a very slim majority, which is why this House seat could determine who has power, depending on who wins. So we'll be watching that. And in case folks don't forget, like April 23rd is the primary. I know a lot of people aren't paying attention because the presidential primary is basically decided. But yes, there are state seats that are being contended for. So we need to pay attention to that as well.
Attorney General as well.
Yeah, exactly. Moving over the bridge to New Jersey, lots of development in the New Jersey race for U.S. Senate. Two candidates have suspended their campaign. The big announcement first came from New Jersey First Lady Tammy Murphy. Murphy announced that she would no longer be in the race, and her decision came in wake of several political blows. We talked about this over the past few days, Avi, including a challenge to the state's county line balloting system that was brought by Congressman Andy Kim. It was also determined that the attorney general would not, you know, defend this county line balloting system. She also saw a major endorsement switch from her column to Kim's column, as well as some other criticism. So she put out this video over the weekend. As you may recall, incumbent Senator Bob Menendez, who is facing multiple federal charges, he said he will not run for re-election, although he reserved the option to run as an independent. So this means on the Democratic side that basically Andy Kim is the person to beat. The second announcement came from the GOP side. TV journalist Alex Zidane dropped out of the race on the GOP side. It leaves two potential folks competing for now for the GOP nomination. So that's another race we're going to be paying attention to.
Yeah, more clarity now. What looked like it was going to be a very messy and competitive race. And that looks like Andy Kim is likely going to be the Democrat. Of course, we expect Democrats to have an advantage in a Senate race in New Jersey. But this is all coming in the wake of scandal related to a Democratic U.S. senator. So could that affect the race in November? We shall see. One more thing out of New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
When I say New Jersey food to you, you might think saltwater taffy.
Yeah.
Tomato pie.
Okay.
Maybe a hoagie.
Maybe.
Oh, you're not giving them credit for Oh, wow. Well, that's a whole nother segment. But I bet you don't think, I'm going to get my hands on some New Jersey maple syrup.
Definitely not.
The AP had a really interesting story about an effort at Stockton University, South Jersey. They got $1 million from the USDA to try to explore the possibility of tapping into, the maple syrup industry in South Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
You can't grow like the typical Vermont sugar maples down in South Jersey, but you can grow red maples, which don't yield as much sap sort of per gallon collected or as much usable syrup per gallon of sap collected. So it seems like a bit of an uphill battle, but maybe New Jersey can make it happen and you can someday be putting some New Jersey syrup on your waffles or your pancakes.
What was interesting to me, Avi, about this story is that New Jersey, they produced about 1,800 gallons of maple syrup worth about $88,000. And I did the math, and folks feel free to check my math, but that is about $48 a gallon. That's some expensive, you know, maple syrup, whereas it can be produced in Vermont for about $17 a gallon. So it's just, you know, it just seems like it's going to be tough. But the woman, Judith Vogel, she runs the Stockton Maple Project. She says, never tell a New Jerseyan it can't be done because we live for a challenge. So they've accepted the challenge there.
I wonder what's the best meal you can make out of just products sourced from New Jersey or Pennsylvania, for that matter.
They have maple syrup, maple candies. I like them.
But could you make a whole meal? Like, imagine you got to get the salt. You got to get oil sourced from the state. You got to get the basics. You got to get flour. I wonder if you could put a whole meal together just based on things sourced from any one state. And which state would be the best? Probably California.
Maybe. Anybody got to want to accept that challenge? Coming up with that? I have no idea.
I want to eat that meal, an all New Jersey meal.
Exactly. So we're going to jump into our newsmaker. As you likely heard, a cargo ship struck the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore early this morning, causing that bridge to collapse. According to the latest information that we have, authorities are still searching for at least six people, including construction workers who were on the bridge at the time. Of course, the search for those workers is the top priority, especially right now. And we're thinking of everybody down in Baltimore.
And there's a lot we still don't know about this disaster, but we wanted to at least add some context on the shipping and supply industry to help us all make better sense of what has happened in Baltimore this morning. So joining us now is Dr. Rich Young, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Supply Chain Management at Penn State. Dr. Young, thank you for joining us on Studio 2.
Good afternoon. My pleasure.
Rich, you know, experts have said that container ships like the Dolly are a different animal when it comes to dealing with safety and collisions. Could you describe this ship for us, giving us an understanding of the size and power?
Yeah, I am, you know, like the rest of you and most of your listeners, you've probably seen some of the footage. That vessel, at least to me, looks like it's rated at somewhere around 12,000 to 15,000 TEUs. Let me explain what a TEU is. That's a container. 20 foot is TEU is 20 foot equivalent unit. And so 15,000 of those, it's a lot of containers. It's not the largest container ship out there, but it is significant, which also means that this ship is of a reasonably good size and can do a lot of damage when it's pointed in the wrong direction.
We have heard reports substantiated by officials that the ship may have lost power before striking the bridge. What types of power systems do these vessels typically have? Do they have redundancies, backup systems? How does that work?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting question, right? They're diesel powered, and, you know, you've got electrical systems, and you have those diesel generators that are, the diesel engines are powering generators that are providing electricity for all sorts of things. There are some backup systems for that. I saw the same clips that you saw where it looked like the lights went out for a period of time just prior to it striking the bridge. I don't know what that means. I don't know what the cause of that would be. But, you know, ships like this, understand that, if you're in that body of water, that ship has a pilot on the bridge, and that pilot is a very skilled, qualified mariner who knows those waters there like the back of his hand.
And got to ask you, are these ships easily maneuvered? Because this, you know, there could a possible power outage here. Is it something that could be, you know, a quick change in direction? How hard is it to maneuver these types of ships?
You need to have a lot of forethought as to where you're going with that. To answer your question with a simple answer, no, they're not easily maneuverable. They don't have a brake pedal like your car. If you want to stop one, you can, you know, you're looking at probably a mile at least to do anything of any consequence. You could drop a stern anchor, you can put it in reverse, but even at that, it's going to take a long distance before anything happens. It's a tremendous amount of weight, which means you have a tremendous amount of inertia. So if it's hitting the bridge, you're going to get a result like we've seen on TV.
Yeah.
Obviously, the safety of the folks on that bridge is paramount and foremost right now. But eventually, folks are going to have to figure out what to do with supply chains along the East Coast for the ships that would have docked here at the Port of Baltimore. Do we have a sense of what might happen moving forward and how places like Philadelphia might be impacted by that?
Well, let's back up and look at what transpired with COVID. We had massive disruptions of supply chains. People were concerned because they'd go to a grocery store and they couldn't find toilet paper. We're still seeing in the assembly industries, particularly automotive and commercial aircraft assembly, that certain components are still, it's still nip and tuck as far as getting components in place on those assembly lines for when the assemblers need to put them together. And when you lose a port like Baltimore, remember, I've only been talking so far about container vessels, but Baltimore has a tremendous amount of what's referred to as roll-on, roll-off traffic. It's a port where you get a large number of incoming assembled motor vehicles that are destined to dealers throughout the Mid-Atlantic, and you also have a very large amount of roll-on, roll-off traffic that's outbound. Farm equipment is probably, I'm going to say farm equipment may actually be heading the list.
Wow.
So what happens to those ships? Do they go to Philadelphia? Can they go to Philadelphia or to another port nearby?
Well, ports are vastly different from one another. If I look at the Port of Philadelphia, the Port of Philadelphia is the preeminent port for produce coming into the Mid-Atlantic region, which means that all the infrastructure, I'll be careful using the word all, but a lot of the infrastructure in Philadelphia is geared to being able to accommodate the handling of produce. You know, produce is not something that you want sitting around for any period of time. If it happens to be delayed and it sits on a ship for an extra week or two, you know, that's a serious concern.
Got to ask you, with this bridge out, how will it impact trucking and car traffic? This is a weekend coming up where a lot of folks may be traveling. What is the impact of that?
Well, it's interesting because if you look at transportation systems, you can't just look at maritime in isolation. You have to look at maritime and how it's linked into rail, how it's linked into highway. And it's going to be a complex situation. If I were an importer or an exporter, I would be concerned, and I'm sure that the major firms that are in that business are already looking at what their alternatives might be. You know, certainly maritime is dependent on trucking. And you know, we pick a different port to bring cargo into, that that means that those goods are going to be trucked a greater distance.
Interesting. That is Dr. Rich Young, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of Supply Chain Management at Penn State. Dr. Young, thank you for being with us today on Studio 2.
My pleasure. Have a good day.
And coming up, we're talking about protest and dissent and how it's at the core of American patriotism. Stay with us. Lots to come.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Temple Professor Ralph Young ends his latest book with a call to action. We need to dissent. Young argues that dissent is our national fuel, the thing that moves us closer toward our founding ideals. But what is dissent and what makes it an American tradition?
And that's what we're going to ask Ralph Young today. His latest book is American Patriots, A Short History of Dissent. We say short, it covers roughly 400 years from early religious dissenters like Roger Williams all the way up to the Black Lives Matter movement and beyond. So we're going to do our best to speed through it in about 20 minutes. Ralph Young, welcome to Studio 2.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And we know we have some dissenters in our listening audience. What are your thoughts about dissent in America? Have you participated in dissent? Give us a call. The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Ralph, got to ask you, your previous book titled Dissent, The History of an American Idea was published just in 2015. Mm-hmm. Another comprehensive history of 400 years of protest. Why did you feel you needed to update the book so soon?
Well, January 6th kind of propelled me to do that. In the previous book, I basically argue that dissent is just going against the grain, whatever the grain is, and, you know, protesting against the status quo. But it also struck me that what was happening on January 6th was not really dissent, because these people were invading the Capitol based on a lie, based on conspiracy theories. It wasn't based in truth or the ideas of what the founders put into the Constitution. You know, we put the right to dissent in the First Amendment. Mm. And remember, when the Constitutional Convention met, they realized that this was an experiment. This is going to be the first time for a democratic republic in which we, the people, run the country. And so they felt that, you know, by putting in all these rights that we have in the Bill of Rights, that people also need the right to dissent in case we feel that our rights are not being protected or being sustained by the government.
And quick follow-up to you. Very early in your book, you lay out the difference between dissent that has this moral tie and faux dissent. Mm-hmm. And could you explain the difference between the two? And you touched on it a little bit.
Right. With those people that invaded the Capitol, that would be faux dissent, because it wasn't based on truth. It wasn't that they had been enduring centuries or decades of Jim Crow, for example. They weren't, you know, their rights weren't being trampled on. And what they were trying to do actually was overturn an election, which was basically going to be overturning the rights of the, what was it, 81 million people that voted for Biden. So by trying to do that, that goes against the democratic principles that everybody has equal rights in this country.
Mm. You profile dissenters on the far left and the far right in this book. People who disagree with those folks might say they weren't motivated by what they consider to be truth. So how do you distinguish? You say they're not motivated by truth in the example of January 6th, and many people would agree with that. Mm-hmm. But how does that distinguish from other dissenters from prior generations who many people might look at and say they're motivated by lies or at least misunderstandings?
Yeah. Well, there is, you know, probably most of the dissent in America has occurred from the left or from more progressive movements, people wanting more, you know, to get their rights that they felt that were being infringed upon. Conservative dissent, like, for example, the anti-abortion movement, or, for example, in the 1920s, you had the country moving in a direction of modernism with the flappers, women getting the right to vote, mm-hmm. with new philosophies coming in, with the change of the landscape with the Model T Ford, and you had a lot of people resisting that. You know, a lot of Americans wanted to go into this, unforeseeable future, and a lot of people said, no, I don't want to go there. So you had prohibition, you had the nativist movement that was very much against immigrants coming in from non-Protestant countries. And also you had another example of conservative dissent was when the women's movement first began getting traction for women's suffrage. You had an anti-suffrage movement rise up against it. And I look at conservative dissent, even when sometimes if I don't agree with it, I do think it acts as somewhat of a break, or it slows down the process to make sure people think about, do we want these changes, these progressive changes that a lot of people want? Perhaps we have to go incrementally there.
You've said that dissent works to bring change using a process called erosion. Explain how dissent mm-hmm. works to actually change a country, mm-hmm. change viewpoints, expand rights.
Well, you know, this is actually a metaphor I got from one of my students who pointed out in an essay that dissent is like an erosion. It's like, you know, the ocean pounding against the side of a cliff, and eventually it turns, you know, rock into sand. And what it is that there's these basic assumptions that people have in society. And when dissenters began protesting that women have rights, for example, it eventually gets to a point where enough people get convinced by that argument that it kind of erodes the normal assumption that women don't have equal rights. And so then you start shifting into the direction where you have people thinking, more people are starting to agree with dissenters in that case.
Here's a comment from Louise in Pottstown who says, I've taken part in a few protests over the years, and openly expressing myself is exhilarating and makes me feel very American. What about dissent, Ralph, do you think is particularly American? Because people have disagreements on issues like, you know, women's rights all over the world, all the time.
Yeah.
What do you find about dissent that makes it particularly American?
Yeah. You know, of course, the United States, you know, Americans did not invent dissent. It's always, people have been dissenting for thousands of years. But we put it into the Constitution, and we've sort of enhanced that right in a way that people know from day one that, you know, this is kind of an American right, that we all can voice our opinions and protest against any injustices that we see. And, you know, from when that was put into the Constitution, you know, Americans, you know, they, as I sometimes say, they haven't shut up since. They've been protesting about everything. Women protesting for the right to vote. Abolitionists protesting against slavery. Workers protesting for the right to unionize. Every war in our history has had its protesters. By the time you get to the 20th century, you have so many civil rights movements, not just with African Americans, but with LGBTQ, with American Indians, you know, the American Indian movement, Chicanos, Latinos, you know, just about every group has taken this right very seriously. And they look at the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence as a contract. You know, we agree to obey your laws, but you have to protect these rights of ours. And if we're not experiencing those rights fully, we have a right to protest for that. And I think this is something that's really, you know, Americans have taken very seriously. It's in our DNA because the country was founded by dissenters.
Yeah, I think about that. And there are also times, though, in the history that America saw dissent as a threat. And I'm thinking about between the world wars, laws were created to silence people. There were other times in history, and we're seeing some of that in certain states right now. Can you talk about the backlash to too much dissent and efforts to stop it?
Yeah, well, basically every dissent movement eventually creates its own dissent movement. You know, when the patriots, you know, the revolutionaries at the time of the American Revolution, they were a minority of people in the colonies. But eventually, as they started getting some success in their movement for independence, you had the loyalists rise up very strongly against them. And so you had, you know, first, these patriots are basically protesting against England. Then you have the loyalists protesting against the patriots. During the Civil War, Lincoln suspended the right of habeas corpus. During the First World War, Wilson signed the Espionage Act, which limited dissent against the First World War. And this, of course, is one reason why the American Civil Liberties Union was founded, as a reaction against the Espionage Act. So, you know, it seems like in every moment of crisis, the United States tends to try to stifle dissent to some extent. Think of September 11th and the Patriot Act that came into existence after that.
Yeah.
And sometimes you can look at a single dissenter, and it's hard to determine whether they're a progressive or a reactionary dissenter. And you bring up the case of William Jennings Bryan, who I hope folks might remember. Was sort of a progressive figure and sort of a reactionary figure, depending on sort of what lens you view him through. He was a longtime Democratic president for candidate over and over and over again. But you talk about his role in what's known as the Scopes Monkey Trial, which is, if people don't remember, this was a trial in Tennessee where a teacher was put on trial for teaching evolution. And William Jennings Bryan was, you know, prosecuting the teacher in this case, but doing so from a perspective of trying to, in his mind, bring about, I guess, greater equality and to stop some of the social Darwinism that had taken hold in society. So let's talk a little bit about William Jennings Bryan.
Yeah, exactly. He was a very interesting figure. He was very progressive. He was a progressive Democrat. He also was a fundamentalist Christian, and he was like a lay preacher. And it wasn't so much that he was against the theory of evolution, but he was very much against the way that that theory was being implemented by philosophers like William Graham Sumner and Herbert Spencer, which created this idea of social Darwinism, that millionaires are the product of natural selection.
And the strong dominate the weak.
And the strong dominate the weak. And so William Jennings Bryan, in becoming the prosecuting attorney for in the Scopes trial, was doing it from both ends of the spectrum, as a progressive trying to destroy social Darwinism, but also trying to protect the literal interpretation of the Bible.
And sort of traditional Christianity and Christian values.
Exactly.
And I think about some of the responses that we're seeing now in states with book bans, don't say gay bills, you know, sort of quelling LGBTQ expression. You know, bills that look at what teachers are saying in classrooms. It sort of reminds me of that. Are there other points in history where we saw this sort of backlash to liberalism come in and try to put the kibosh on things?
Yeah, well, you know, as I said, just about every dissent movement does get people opposing it. And you had, for example, you know, when the Beatnik movement, you know, came into existence, you had a lot of people trying to ban the books of, like, how Allen Ginsberg's Howl was banned for a while until it was put on trial, and then it was, the judge declared it was actually literature, which of course just made more people want to buy it when it was published. You have this, you know, one of the things that's so extraordinary to me now is the anti, you know, because of the strength of the Black Lives Matter movement, then suddenly this this anti-movement against the 1619 Project and against critical race theory. And basically, the people who are opposed to that don't really quite understand what critical race theory is. They think that it, you know, it's basically a philosophical way of examining, you know, laws that have been created in the United States that sort of strengthen racism.
Here's an email from Carol who says they attended a protest and were prohibited from entering City Hall, I assume City Hall in Philadelphia. She says keeping protesters away from policymakers just doesn't seem to be a way for them to hear each other. Speaking of trying to force your way into somewhere you're not supposed to be, perhaps, I want to bring up this example from 1971, and I'll take you to the scene. This is March of 71, and this is the night of a major boxing title fight between Philadelphia's Joe Frazier and Muhammad Ali. Let's hear a little sound.
Here comes Joe Frazier. Here comes Joe Frazier, ladies and gentlemen. There seems to be a mingling of boos along with the applause. I don't know why. This man is a gallant champion.
And as everyone is tuned in to that big title match, eight anti-war activists break into an FBI field office in Media, Pennsylvania, and steal a lot of files. And it turns out to be pretty, they get a lot of good stuff from stealing those files. And I wanted to ask you to talk about that incident, but also, you know, where, you know, burglary, vandalism, even violence fit into the American tradition of dissent.
Yeah. Well, one example of vandalism is the Boston Tea Party. So, you know, there's a lot of good examples of that in our history. And of course, the American Revolution itself was violent dissent. What's very interesting about the Media FBI office break-in was that these protesters that did that, you know, they, of course, did not harm anybody at all. There was no physical violence. It was just breaking, entering, stealing these files. And then they began distributing them to the Washington Post and the New York Times. And one of the things that these files exposed was the Intel COINTEL program of the FBI. Nobody had even heard of that before. And I got one of, I think it was one of the New York Times reporters, began investigating what does this COINTEL pro mean. And within a couple of years, uncovered this, which led to the church committee and Congress examining the FBI and you know, trying to put some rules around how the FBI is supposed to behave, because the FBI was basically undermining anti-war groups, civil rights groups, trying to destroy them from within.
Wow, that's so interesting. You also talk about the Occupy Wall Street movement, and you say that it was not a successful act of dissent. Why do you say it was not successful?
Well, it was locked into a place, and as long as they were occupying that one square, and then of course it spread to other places. But once it was, people were kicked out of it or dragged out of it by the police, it no longer really had any momentum going to it. But what it did do is it raised the question about the 99% against the 1%. And before the Occupy movement, nobody was talking about that. After that, even though the movement itself failed, people are talking about it.
Got to ask you, we've had Me Too, we've had Black Lives Matter, we had Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street, so many different protests, and you say that we need to dissent. Lay out your argument as we wrap up, and just sort of, what are you hoping people take from your book?
Well, one of the things is that dissent always has to be, you can be somewhat successful or successful, but then there's always the backlash against it. And for example, women's rights organizations were happy when Roe v. Wade was passed, but then, of course, it was overturned. Things that you think have been won, people have to continue fighting for to maintain them. And, so another really important thing that people need to protest about right now is this whole climate change issue and the fact that politicians are just not doing anywhere near enough about that.
Thank you, Ralph Young. Ralph Young is the author of American Patriots, A Short History of Dissent, and a professor of instruction in history at Temple University. Appreciate you being here today.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure.
And we're going to close this segment with a song written by Woody Guthrie to protest poverty back in the early 1940s. This Land Is Your Land. This version is performed by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings.
This land is my land.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. Cherry, let's talk about green bubbles.
Okay.
I'm not talking about bubbles that run on biofuel. I'm talking about little green text bubbles that pop up on your Apple iPhone when you get a message from someone using an Android. Sure, they're annoying, but are they really evidence that Apple is a monopolist?
Well, according to a lawsuit filed last week by the Department of Justice and 16 states, that answer, Avi, is yes. They say those green bubble texts don't function as well as the blue bubble texts from this iPhone. They also claim Apple keeps competitors out of its app store and don't even bother trying to sync your Apple Watch with an Android.
Add it all up, and the government says Apple is using technological traps to make users dependent on its iPhone. One of the entities making that claim is the state of New Jersey, which has signed on to a major antitrust case, the one we just talked about. With us now to explain why is New Jersey Attorney General Matt Plotkin. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So, Matt, before we go into the details of the lawsuit against Apple, it was filed in New Jersey, your home state. What makes the Garden State the right venue?
Well, we're honored to lead this case alongside the Department of Justice in what Attorney General Garland described as one of the largest cases ever filed in the history of this country. And we're honored that they chose to file it in New Jersey. Look, New Jerseyans are harmed by the conduct we discussed in Apple. There's a lot of businesses that are here that are harmed. And so it's the right place for the case to be filed.
There's also speculation that it's being filed in New Jersey because folks might think the Third Circuit Court of Appeals is favorable to the government on this particular issue. Can you comment on that?
No. I would just say that like I said, the case is appropriately venued in New Jersey. There are a significant number of people harmed by the conduct here. And, you know, we are a lead state, so it makes sense for it to be filed in our state.
And so let's dig into the claims against Apple. Let's go over it. Why did you decide to include New Jersey in this lawsuit? And what are some of the issues that you have with the Apple's technology and their practices?
Well, if you think back to the 1990s, when the Department of Justice in many states sued Microsoft for restricting using its market share to restrict business practices in a way that stifled innovation, Apple was a lead witness in that case. And ultimately, it was that case that allowed the iTunes platform to get on the Windows platform, that led to the iPod and then the iPhone. And fast forward a couple of decades now, you see Apple essentially following the Microsoft playbook, where they've used their market share. And there's nothing inherently illegal about being a big company. But when you use that size to push other businesses out, create business practices that stifle innovation, that restrict user choice in a way that violates our laws and ultimately hurts consumers. You know, if you think about now, a consumer is paying over $1,500 for an iPhone that, if you adjust the 2007 price for inflation, should only cost $450. So these practices, and I'm happy to talk more about them, have really had an impact on how much consumers are spending.
And let's talk specifics. I've heard about the Apple Digital Wallet, the way the smartwatches function, so-called super apps that are being barred from the App Store. How is Apple using its size to restrict competition?
So as we allege in the complaint, Apple has taken a number of steps, you just mentioned several of them, to make it harder for consumers to leave their platform. So you talk about super apps. Well, super apps in many parts of the world are very popular because they're apps that you can do many things within them. You can have chats in them. You can buy products. You can play games and do other things. And what that then allows you to do is go to any other phone that has the app. And often these apps are based in the cloud, so you don't even need a very expensive machine to use it. So Apple has restricted them. Its wallet is another great example of that. So Apple does not allow third-party wallets on its platform to use tap-to-pay function, meaning where you take your phone and you tap it up against the device and pay for it, something that many people do now to pay for products. You can only use the Apple wallet, and they're doing that deliberately to keep its users on the Apple app that can only be used on an iPhone to make it harder for you to switch platforms. And so all of the conduct that we talk here about in this case has made it harder for users to exercise their choice to go to lower cost platforms. And as a result of that, Apple is able to extract significant profits, far greater than what their competitors do, from an iPhone that, again, now costs over $1,500 in many instances. And consumers are paying for that.
And Apple says that, you know, their limitations on competitors helps bolster privacy and security for their customers. They also say they just have a really great product and people just love the iPhone. What is your plan defense against an argument like that?
Look, if people are free to love an iPhone, no one's saying that, but what you can't do is use your market share to restrict business practices and consumer choice in a way that violates our laws. And that's exactly what Apple's doing. And we would argue that with respect to privacy and security, that some of Apple's practices that restrict third-party apps or third-party app stores on their platform actually stifled innovation of new of privacy features and security features on their apps and restrict consumers' ability to use and express their preferences. The wallet is a great example of that. It restricts your ability to use your preferred financial institution because you have to operate through the Apple wallet in order to get the full features of the iPhone.
One might say if Apple is using all of this to drive up unfairly the price of its iPhone by making you dependent on it, the consumer already has a choice. Buy a different phone. Mm-hmm. And in fact, just under half of American smartphone customers do use an Android phone. Why isn't that enough of a balance in the marketplace? You know, if Apple boosts the price of this thing too high, people will say, forget it, I'm out of the Apple universe, I'll go over to another phone company.
So it's actually closer to 7 in 10 phones are iPhones. But the fact is, to leave the iPhone platform now is incredibly difficult, because think about all the things you have in your wallet. Think about all the things you use your phone for. Most of the key apps that we're talking about here, you can't then go and use on an Android. And so what Apple has done is it has made it harder for consumers to leave it. I'm not saying none would ever do it, but it's just made it harder for consumers to exercise that choice. And those are restrictions that Apple has deliberately put in place to make it harder, not to improve their competitiveness, not to increase the quality of their product. But the evidence shows, based on a decision to make it harder for consumers to leave their platform. And I think that contributes to why Apple is now spending twice as much money on stock buybacks as it is on R&D, because they know it's harder for their consumers to leave their platform. And as a result, they're able to extract significant profits from their products.
And we mentioned in our introduction, the difference between being able to use the messaging app when you have an iPhone, when you're, I guess, the person on the other end has an iPhone versus, texting back and forth to a non-iPhone user. Can you explain briefly why you say this is an anti-competitive practice?
Sure. And Attorney General Garland highlighted this at the press conference last Thursday. The restricted features that you see when you get the dreaded green bubble are designed by Apple, not by the third-party competitors. All of the things that you can do on an iPhone with iMessage could be done across platforms, but Apple chooses to not allow it because they want the user experience to be much worse when it comes to an iPhone dealing with an Android, so that people don't have are less inclined to go and switch to another platform. That's a choice made by Apple. That's not a feature of the Android products or any of the other products in the marketplace. And that's what we talk about when Apple has deliberately taken steps that are anti-competitive to use their market share in a way that makes consumers less likely to leave their platform.
So what's the remedy here? What types of remedies might you seek if you guys are successful in this case?
Well, we'll let the remedies play out in court, but I think there's a number of things that you can see from the complaint that Apple is already starting to do in other parts of the world, like allowing third-party application app stores onto their platform, allowing touch tap to pay features for third-party wallets. But there's a lot of remedies that I think we'll seek, and ultimately, we wouldn't have filed this case, like I said, one of the most significant cases ever filed, if we didn't believe we had the proofs to win it. And we're prepared for that fight.
Well, thank you for joining us today on Studio 2, New Jersey Attorney General Matt Plotkin.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we will reiterate, New Jersey is one of 16 states in the District of Columbia that has joined with the federal government to sue Apple over non-competitive practices. That news came out last week, Jerry, mm-hmm. As we say with so many stories, we will definitely be keeping the apple of our eye on that one.
Yeah, and I will be looking at my iPhone a little bit differently, I think. I kind of like the
question now is whether we tell folks to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts today.
I know. Mm. Or you can look in any of the...
That's right.
Use any podcast app. Spotify, I think we're available on all platforms.
Yeah.
Wherever you choose to get your podcast.
Wherever you choose competitively to get your podcast. We are there. This is Studio 2. Let's thank some folks as we wrap up the show today.
Our producers are Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Al Banks engineered the show today. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I am Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk to you tomorrow.